Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and we're going to fly through the obligatories because we need to focus on content. Because what I'm trying to do, folks, just really quick, I'm trying to create a great content repository for you, because I know I can't just do these shows over and over and over and over and over and over again, because we're getting to a point where things are happening and people are actually getting so agitated and getting active that is going to become more important. So we're actually going to be doing multiple shows. We'll still air or have the content, but I think you need to hear the ground truth and those other things. So anyway, we were covering the Pennsylvania debates. And in the last section that we just covered, there was a point that was brought up by Mr. Wilson regarding Blackstone and his commentaries. And he says this. I know we covered this, but I want to highlight this. I mentioned that Blackstone will tell you that in Britain, it is lodged sovereignty. It is lodged in the British Parliament. And I believe there is no writer on this subject on the other side of the Atlantic, but suppose it to be vested in that body. I stated further that if the question was asked of some politician who had not considered in America, he's talking about any politician in America who has not considered the subject with sufficient accuracy, where the supreme power resided in our governments here, he would answer that it was vested in the state constitutions. Therefore, because of the makeup of this hybrid constitutional republic, because we actually have different sovereign and independent states, we have a very limited general government that serves these independent sovereign states in a very specific capacity. So they are not the full sovereigns. When you really measure where the sovereignty lies, one would say at that level, for the federal government, it would be the states. But I would submit that as we look and examine the states themselves being Republican in form and being republics within this national republic, that the counties are really where the sovereignty should lie. Jefferson even alluded to this as he started understanding the system. And so, when we go and we want to consider Blackstone's commentaries, it's insightful for Britain and how that monarchical theocracy functioned, but it is not applicable here. Because the Bible in Britain is the supreme law, and that's where the recurrence would go to, is the supreme law being followed? In America, the Bible is not our supreme law of the government. We have a very limited and defined government, and ergo, that limited and defined government only does these things. Everything is left to the people or that other sub-government. So, technically, we need to actually have this Blackstone commentaries for every state. I've been saying this for the longest time, that we literally need to have somebody write your own Blackstone commentaries, or let's call them Bob's commentaries, on the state of Wyoming. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. So, let's dive down to the next sovereignty, and let's go ahead and kind of read that, because I want to avoid going into these long rat holes. I want to kind of just keep things moving. But in explaining all of these things, it takes a little bit of time. So by all means, go ahead and shock me or whatever. Hey, shut up if I'm talking too much. But anyway, okay, go ahead.
Not really sure how to do that.
Okay.
So we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive to these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such forms as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness.
Okay, so this right there, right there, folks, that was the Declaration of Independence, right? So now he's kind of going to explain this idea, the sovereignty, and how this all, you know, comes together. So go ahead, keep going.
This is the broad basis on which our independence was placed. On the same certain and solid foundation, this system is erected. States and sovereignty, as it is called, is far from being able to support its weight. Nothing less than the authority of the people could either support it or give it efficacy. I cannot pass over this subject without noticing the different conduct pursued by the late Federal Convention and that observed by the convention which framed the Constitution of Pennsylvania. On that occasion, you find an attempt made to deprive the people of this right, so lately and so expressly asserted in the Declaration of Independence. We are told in the preamble to the Declaration of Rights and Frame of Government that we do by virtue of the authority vested in us ordain, declare, and establish the following Declaration of Rights and Frame of Government to be the Constitution of this Commonwealth, and to remain in force therein mattered, except in such articles as shall hereafter on experience be found to require improvement, and which shall by the same authority of the people fairly delegated as this frame of government directs. An honorable gentleman, Mr. Chambers, was well warranted in saying that all that could be done was done to cut off the people from the right of amending, for it cannot be amended by any other mode than that which it directs, than any number more than one-third may control any number less than two-thirds. But I return to my general reasoning. My position is, sir, that in this country the supreme, absolute, and uncontrollable power resides in the people at large, that they have vested certain proportions of this power in the state governments, but that the fee simple continues, resides and remains with the body of the people. Under the practical influence of this great truth, we are now sitting and deliberating, and under its operation we can sit as calmly and deliberate as coolly in order to change a constitution as the legislature can sit and deliberate under the power of a constitution in order to alter or amend a law. It is true the exercise of this power will not probably be so frequent, nor resorted to on so many occasions, in one case as in the other, but the recognition of the principle cannot fail to establish it more firmly. But because this recognition is made in the proposed Constitution, an exception is taken to the whole of it, for we are told it is a violation of the present Confederation, a confederation of sovereign states. I shall not enter into an investigation of the present Confederation, but shall just remark that its principle is not the principle of free government. The people of the United States are not as such represented in the present Congress and considered even as the component parts of the several states. They are not represented in proportion to their numbers and importance.
Okay, so he's laying out a lot here, and he's really laying out how the constitutions, literally by we the people, we create these things. And so when you look at the creation of the federal constitution, it wasn't really created by the state legislatures. They chose delegates to go do that. At the state level, the counties selected delegates to go create that state constitution. In the federal constitution, these men were so wise that they understood the importance of protecting the minority of the least populated state. And they came to these conclusions because, bottom line, there were lots of states, and we already exposed this to you, that there were lots of states that did not want to have the power gone, or the power given to the federal government in legislative powers to be based solely upon the people. So what they did was they created a balance between that. What Mr. Wilson is saying here is that when we look at even the state governments, the states are not represented, or not represent, not representative of the people in the Articles of Confederation. In other words, the Articles of Confederation, Continental Congress, has all equality, and the appointments are made by the state legislature. They don't have people representing them, and it's not this equal body, or I should say, a fair representation of the people of the different areas. So in other words, this goes back to the heart and the design of the legislative body in Congress was to have two separate representatives. One representative body would represent the state legislature, and they would be equal one state to the next. The other body would represent the people and their interests within the equal-sized area. So they created congressional districts, and each representative would represent no more than 30,000 people. And so the House of Representatives was based on population, where some states had more representatives and the less populated states had less. That way, the people had equal representation amongst themselves based on that communal or that community that they were living. And so it created this perfect balance. And the federal government, or I should say this federal constitution, did something that actually poked and created this change even in the state constitutions, because most states at this point in time, with the federal constitution in the process of being ratified, most states started waking up and going, hey, why don't we have a bicameral legislative body based on the governments and the people the same way? And so the constitution was the exemplar of how to have a more perfect government. And so it started leading the way. Today, as we understand the Constitution better and better, we could actually implement it in so many better ways. But I digress. The whole point is that he's really going through this overall design and this failure of real representation of the people. And he jumps into this in this next part of this oration for this day. He goes into representation. So let's read that.
I say, sir, that it was the design of this system to take some power from the state governments and to place it in the general government. It was also the design that the people should be admitted to the exercise of some powers which they did not exercise under the present federation. It was thought proper that the citizens as well as the state should be represented. How far the representation in the Senate is a representation of states, we shall see by and by when we come to consider that branch of the federal government.
Okay, so we'll examine that a little bit more. But now he wants to dive into this jurisdiction, because this is one of the points that comes up. So let's go ahead and jump into that, because there's something that comes up in this, and I'll highlight it after you're done. Go ahead.
Okay. Do we wish a return of those interactions and tumults to which a sister state was lately exposed, or a government of such insufficiency as the present is found to be? Let me, sir, mention one circumstance in the recollection of every honorable gentleman who hears me. To the determination of Congress are submitted all disputes between states concerning boundary, jurisdiction, or right of soil. In consequence of this power, after much altercation, expense of time, and considerable expense of money, this state was successful enough to obtain a decree in her favor, and a difference then subsisting between her and Connecticut. But what was the consequence? The Congress had no power to carry the decree into execution. Hence the distraction and animosity which have ever since prevailed and still continue in that part of the country. Ought the government then to remain any longer incomplete? I hope not. No person can be so insensible to the lessons of experience as to desire it.
Okay, so there's actually two parts of this. The one part is who has the responsibility of dealing with the disputes between the states? And it says right here, to the determination of Congress. In other words, the states are submitting themselves to Congress. In the determination of Congress are submitted all disputes between states concerning boundary, jurisdiction, or even right of soil, and those types of things. The same thing with commerce. Those things are in Article 1, Section 8. Those things all are applied here. Now, he goes on and says, he points out that they went to Continental Congress in a dispute between Connecticut and themselves, Pennsylvania, and Congress gave them a favorable, you know, ruling, but they couldn't get it executed because Congress had no power to do that. And so he basically says, do we want that to continue? Or do we want actually to have an energetic government that can actually say and deliver justice for us? The point really, though, folks, is that these cases go to Congress, not the court. The court only hears if the Constitution is being violated outside of what Congress decided. And what ended up happening out the gate is the court started aggrandizing itself to basically pull everything in as much as possible so that they would actually become and transform this nation into a judiciary form of government instead of a Republican form of government. I point back to the selection of the delegates going to the Constitutional Convention. Each of the states did an empowerment and enabling of the delegates. And in some of those states, they identified the body representatives, the state legislature, as the grand court. They considered themselves the jury to decide all things. And so there's nothing more sacred in our common law and in our governing system than the power of the jury to basically make sure that justice is being maintained. Unfortunately, we've perverted this whole thing to where we've, you know, all started siding based on our demographics from race, gender, and so forth to push agendas instead of the law. Because bottom line, when you look at the law, and we're all enforcing the law, and the law is inadequate, then we can change it. But if everybody just adapts their own mentality and provides their own determination, then we're no longer following the rule of law.
Right.
Okay. All right, so let's jump down to commerce.
So commerce isn't highlighted. Do you want me to read it?
Actually,
if you scroll down a little.
Yeah, there you go.
Mm-hmm. Okay. No man is obliged to consume more than he pleases, and each buys in proportion only to his consumption. The price of commodity is blended with the tax, and the person is often not sensible of the payment. But would it have been proper to rest the matter there? Suppose this fund should not prove sufficient. Ought the public debts to remain unpaid, or the exigencies of government be left unprovided for? Should our tranquility be exposed to the assaults of foreign enemies or violence among ourselves because the objects of commerce may not furnish a sufficient revenue to secure them all? Certainly Congress should possess the power of raising revenue from their constituents for the purpose mentioned in the 8th section of the first article, that is, to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. It has been common with the gentlemen on this subject to present us with frightful pictures. We are told of the hosts of tax gatherers that will swarm through the land, and whenever taxes are mentioned, military force seems to be an attending idea. I think I may venture to predict the taxes of the general government, if any shall be laid, will be more equitable and much less expensive than those imposed by state governments.
Right, because the federal government was limited to only doing certain things. The federal government had to get and convince the states to allow them to spend money on other things. And so that's how there's this collusion and corruption. Because had the states held the line and said, no, you can't do those things. Don't bring us money to kind of tempt us to try to find a better life, you know, in spending money on things that you shouldn't be spending. There's a reason why you don't have that power. But instead, well, hey, who cares what's going to happen down the road? This is money coming into my hand or our hands now, and it empowers me. There was the cycle of corruption. So let's go ahead to the next one, necessary and proper.
It is urged as a general objection to this system that the powers of Congress are unlimited and undefined, and that they will be the judges in all cases of what is necessary and proper for them to do. To bring this subject to your view, I need to do no more than to point to the words in the Constitution, beginning at the 8th section, 1st article, the Congress, it says, shall have power, etc. Mm-hmm. I need not read over the words, but I leave it to every gentleman to say whether the powers are not as accurately and minutely defined as can be well done on the same subject in the same language. The old Constitution is as strongly marked on this subject, and even the concluding clause, with which so much fault has been found, gives no more or other powers, nor does it in any degree go beyond the particular enumeration. For when it is said that Congress shall have power to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper, those words are limited and denned by the following, for carrying into execution the foregoing powers. It is saying no more than that the powers we have already particularly given shall be effectually carried into execution.
Right, so denned, he's limited, and instead of saying denned, limited and contained by the following.
And contained.
Right, okay. So it's kind of, could you do
it? Yeah, I didn't know if that was a typo or what.
No, it's just, it's a vernacular, the way they spoke. But he's just pointing out that how much more accurate could it be for carrying into execution the foregoing powers? And we kind of highlighted this before. Mm-hmm. So in other words, he's kind of regurgitating or going back through, you know, these enumerations and the necessary and proper clause. The day before they talked about, or 2 days ago, they talked about the necessary and proper clause, and they're still making hay on it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So now we jump down one more time into commerce. Go ahead.
Okay. The letter which accompanies this Constitution must strike every person with the utmost force. The friends of our country have long seen and desired that the power of war, peace, and treaties, that of levying money and regulating commerce, and the corresponding executive and judicial authorities, should be fully and effectually vested in the general government of the Union. But the impropriety of delegating such extensive trust to one body of men is evident. Hence results the necessity of a different organization.
Okay, so it's really clear that everything, and he said this before, everything, if you go through each of the lines, the Congress shall have the power to do this, 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 is there any way that these are really open-ended to where Congress can really get away with doing all sorts of things? And the answer, really, when you go through it, folks, is no. They can establish a uniform rule for naturalization and bankruptcies across the Union, something like that. I mean, that's it. They just can't make all sorts of laws regarding citizenship, only the uniform rule of naturalization. They can determine a common, agreeable standard for what bankruptcies are. They don't even abide by that anymore. They literally said, well, we don't have to have a uniform rule of bankruptcy. We now have this caveated. We'll allow bankruptcy for everything except for our debt. You take debt from us, we'll hold you to the T. Well, that's not uniform. So in other words, these student loans, because they're government loans, oh, well, that's not forgivable. But everybody else's debt is. How is that uniform?
Right.
Okay. So when you really understand the language in those powers that were delegated, they were very specific. And that's why nobody really said anything more. They keep on trying to pick on the necessary and proper clause or these things that we find as ambiguous. So we're going into break. And so with that, when we come back, we'll kind of jump into some slavery comments and state constraints and so forth. But this, as you can tell, there's really no anti-federalist. He just keeps on getting up and trying to state the same things differently regarding necessary, proper, and so forth. We'll be right back after this. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, we've kind of already covered slavery, but what's really important is that they bring up these topics throughout this. I wanted to make sure we gave you all the detail. In other words, they do talk about slavery. You're hiding something because, you know, obviously you're not having them read this part of where they're talking about slavery or something like that. What we want to do for full disclosure is help you see that all they're doing is they're walking around the woodshed, explaining the woodshed to you in different ways. They're not redefining it to say, okay, well, it's a woodshed this time, but actually it's a chicken coop the next time. And actually, it's the general store, and it's the, you know, the butcher, and then it's the stable. It's, you see my point? They're trying to make sure that you get full clarity, because sometimes when you walk around the woodshed, you just talk about the surface materials. You talk about the dimensions. So it helps reiterate and reiterate so that when everybody walks away, they know that, boy, this thing is about a woodshed. And they know, you know, what's going to be in it. It's going to be wood. It's not chickens. So hopefully that helps. But as we go through these things, if I only gave you just four or five points and you did the due diligence to go, wow, he missed all these other things. Why is he hiding that? Does that make sense? So that's why kind of going through this comprehensively is important. So let's go ahead and attack this discourse on slavery.
I recollect on a former day the honorable gentleman from Durfinley and the honorable gentleman from Cumberland, Mr. Whitehill, took exception against the first clause of the ninth section, Article 1, arguing very unfairly that because Congress might impose tax or duty of $10 on the importation of slaves within any of the United States, Congress might therefore permit slaves to be imported within this state, contrary to its laws. I confess, I little thought that this part of the system would be accepted to. I am sorry that it could be extended no farther, but so far as it operates, it presents us with the pleasing prospect that the rights of mankind will be acknowledged and established throughout the Union. If there was no other lovely feature in the Constitution but this one, it would diffuse a beauty over its whole countenance. Yet the lapse of a few years, and Congress will have power to exterminate slavery from within our borders.
Okay, so he's obviously, as he went around the woodshed, and they have all these different things, it's not just a simple woodshed. The Constitution is it's a pretty comprehensive thing. And so they go, wow, you just said this, but you didn't get into this. And, you know, they could enforce that. They can inflict that. Well, he hasn't said it yet. But there's nowhere where Congress has the power to dictate, you know, to states how to regulate them. As a matter of fact, when you get to the Commerce Clause, it is clear Congress cannot regulate commerce within the states. They can only regulate commerce among the states. And when you look at commerce, that would be labor. That would be the production of things and so forth, right? And so how could they actually inflict any form of labor, any form of commerce, markets, and so forth within a state if they don't have that enumerated? That's the whole point. But keep going. Go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. If there was no other lovely feature in the Constitution but this one,
you're the next one down. Next one down. How would
such a delightful prospect expand the breast of a benevolent and philanthropic. Exactly. European. Would he cavil at an expression, catch at a phrase? No, sir, that is only reserved for the gentleman on the other side of your chair to do. What would be the exultation of the great man whose name I have just now mentioned? We may learn from the following sentiments on this subject. They cannot be expressed so well as in his own words. Volume 1, page 329. The colonies of France contain, as we have seen, near 500,000 slaves, and it is from the number of these wretches the inhabitants set a value on their plantations. What a fatal prospect, and how profound a subject for reflection. Alas, how inconsequent we are both in our mortality and our principles. We preach up humanity and yet go every year to bind in chains 20,000 natives of Africa. We call the Moors barbarians and ruffians because they attack the liberty of Europeans at the risk of their own, yet these Europeans go without danger and as mere speculators to purchase slaves by gratifying the cupidity of their masters and excite all those bloody scenes which are the usual preliminaries of this traffic. In short, we pride ourselves on the superiority of men, and it is with reason that we discover this superiority in the wonderful and mysterious unfolding of the intellectual faculties, and yet the trifling difference in the hair of the head or the color of the epidermis is sufficient to change our respect into contempt and to engage us to place beings like ourselves in the rank of those animals devoid of reason, whom we subject to the yoke that we may make use of their strength and of their instinct and command, at command.
Right. Okay, so I think he's making some really good points here about, you know, the hypocrisy of how we look at these things and so forth. Keep on going, though. Keep on going.
Okay. I am sensible, and I grieve at it, that these reflections, which others have made much better than I, are unfortunately of very little use. The necessity of supporting sovereign power has its peculiar laws, and the wealth of nations is one of the foundations of this power. Thus, the sovereign, who should be the most thoroughly convinced of what is due to humanity, would not singly renounce the service of slaves in his colonies. Time alone could furnish a population of free people to replace them, and the great difference that would exist in the price of labor would give so great an advantage to the nation that should adhere to the old custom that the others would soon be discouraged in wishing to be more virtuous. And yet, would it be a chimerical project to propose a general compact by which all European nations should unanimously agree to abandon the traffic of African slaves? They would, in that case, find themselves exactly in the same proportion relative to each other as at present, for it is only on comparative riches that the calculations of power are founded.
Okay, so the point that I really wanted to bring out here is a multifold, but bottom line, slavery was looked down upon in Pennsylvania. And I don't know if you have heard, but there are many people out there that said, you know, these people back in those days, they were racists and so forth. Did this guy come across as a racist?
Yeah, not at all.
Okay. So when you read the actual source documents and you hear what these people have said, then you go, huh, okay, now what? Are we being lied to? Or is this a misrepresentation? You know, what is the truth? And the truth is that America, you know, I know a lot of people have the ability to, you know, go through a paradigm shift. A paradigm shift is where you see things differently. But that paradigm shift may be an aha moment, but it takes time for you to actually function, act, work, and so forth in that new paradigm because it's new to you. Does that make sense? And so there was this evolutionary process that had to take place. And technically, the divine providence probably understood the fact that you just, you know, granted, you can't pull the rug out from underneath everybody. That's the, probably the, that would have been the best way to do it. However, at minimum, you want to make sure you're on a path that everybody abandons it. And had the Constitution, the spirit of the Constitution been maintained, everybody would have abandoned slavery because it just wouldn't have been worth it. The fact is, and we went through all of the disadvantages for the South even keeping it. They were hostage to their own institution. They couldn't afford to, you know, send people off to do anything. They had to tend to those slaves to keep them slaves, which is why they couldn't go fight in a war, because if they had too many people go fight in a war, then the slaves would actually take over. So they really exposed a lot, and it took time to, you know, to change things. The travesty was the fact that the Constitution was violated by inflicting slavery upon the states. So let's go ahead and go down to the state constraints now regarding this. Go ahead.
Okay. Make sure I'm not on mute. Permit me to make a single observation in this place on the restraints placed on the state governments. If only the following lines were inserted in this Constitution, I think it would be worth our adoption. No state shall hereafter emit bills of credit, make anything but gold and silver coin, a tender in payment of debts, pass any bills of attainder, ex post facto law, a law impairing the obligation of contracts. End quote. Fatal experience has taught us, dearly taught us, the value of these restraints. What is the consequence even at this moment? It is true we have no tender law in Pennsylvania, but the moment you are conveyed across the Delaware, you find it haunt your journey and follow close upon your heels. The paper passes commonly at 25% or 30% discount. How insecure is property?
So, this got me thinking, because if this were looking at the word ex post facto, right? So they came up with all these constraints upon the states. Well, those same constraints were on the federal government. And as a matter of fact, they basically said, hey, you know, we've actually had fatal experience that has taught us why we don't want to have these things. How many people understand today why you don't want to have ex post facto laws? Because, and I'll give you a good case in point, because most people, you know, if you understand HOAs, because, you know, the California HOA is inflicted upon everybody now. You know, it's almost in every state. I probably have it in Wyoming. And so let's just say that the HOAs form to do one thing or another thing or what have you. And all of a sudden, you know, people go in, they vest themselves and so forth. And they basically say, hey, you know, we don't like the idea of people being able to paint their house any color that they want, but that wasn't in the law. In other words, it wasn't in the covenants. It wasn't in the HOA, you know, contract. So they say, we're going to make it, because somebody painted their house, we're going to make it so that you can't paint your house any color you want. Now, it's one thing for people to move into that tract under those conditions, but everybody currently living are not held to that, because if they were held to that, that would be an ex post facto law. Because if they can pass a law that then forces somebody to change the house that they just painted, which they legally and rightfully did, because they had the power to do so until they changed the law. The question is, can an HOA institute ex post facto laws? No. As a matter of fact, the state should actually stand up and say, no, you can't do that. This is repugnant. The federal government can't do it. We can't do it. We cannot enforce any law that violates these types of rights and privileges and protections from ex post facto laws. So my point is that they're kind of covering these consequences because they're learning from these. But today we have no appreciation of these bills of attainder and punishment. You know, these things we call ex post facto laws. What is that? Because we don't understand them. And what ends up happening is we'll actually do this. Fatal experience will teach us. Like he says, fatal experience has taught us. Well, today it'll be fatal experience will teach us. As we allow these things to kill ourselves and so forth, they go, well, shoot, those are ex post facto laws. And technically, now that we know that they can't create them, then we can protect ourselves from them. Anyway, let's keep going, and we want to jump down to the next day, December 7th. So this is the day Japan attacks Pearl Harbor, but that's, you know, well over a century later. But anyway, December 7th, we're talking about treaties. So let's go ahead and dive into what he talks about treaties here. Go ahead.
Okay. The judicial power extends to all cases arising under treaties made, which shall be made by the United States. I shall not repeat at this time what has been said with regard to the power of the states to make treaties. It cannot be controverted that when made, they ought to be observed. But it is highly proper that this regulation should be made, for the truth is, and I am sorry to say it, that in order to prevent the payment of British debts and from other causes, our treaties have been violated, and violated, too, by the express laws of several states in the Union. Pennsylvania, to her honor be it spoken, has hitherto done no act of this kind. But it is acknowledged on all sides that many states in the Union have infringed the treaty, and it is well known that when the Minister of the United States made a demand of Lord Caermarthen of a surrender of the Western Post, he told the minister with truth and justice, the treaty under which you claim those possessions has not been performed on your part. Until that is done, those possessions will not be delivered up. This clause, sir, will show the world that we make the faith of treaties a constitutional part of the character of the United States, that we secure its performance no longer nominally. For the judges of the United States will be enabled to carry it into effect. Let the legislatures of the different states do what they may.
Okay, so he's kind of highlighting the whole point here that under the Articles of Confederation, states were making treaties and they were not abiding by them. They'd say, yeah, just get out of our hair, get out of here, and we'll make everything happy, but then they don't. And so he's kind of helping everybody understand the importance of actually, you know, abiding by and following these types of things, which is one of the reasons why that in order to pay the debts, they basically said that we will honor these previous treaties to these foreign entities. Most people think that those engagements and debts and so forth deal with within the Union. No, that's really a signal to the rest of the world that this new government will honor the old government's engagements with you. Everything else internally, the Constitution superseded. I hear people all the time try to argue that the Northwest Ordinance was still legitimate because it was a treaty made with the people in the Ohio area, the Northwest Territory, that, you know, Continental Congress made this agreement with them. Well, at this point in time, because those were all internal affairs, that actually got superseded by the Constitution. So the admission of those new lands or the Northwest Territory, when they got admitted into the Union, they weren't to follow the Northwest Ordinance. They were to follow the Constitution and its process. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So the whole point of the engagements and treaties and those agreements were with external entities, not within amongst the states and the territories and so forth. Though that was all, we already considered that ours. We already had that in our treaty with Britain, that Northwest Territory was a part of our territory in that treaty with Britain. So anyway, all right, jurisdiction. Let's dive into this one. Go ahead.
Okay. This will also be allowed with regard to the following clause. All cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction. The next is to controversies to which the United States shall be a party. Now, I apprehend it is something very incongruous that because the United States are a party, it should be urged as an objection that their judges ought not to decide when the universal practice of all nations has and unavoidably must have admitted of this power. But say the gentlemen, the sovereignty of the states is destroyed if they should be engaged in a controversy with the United States, because a suitor in a court must acknowledge the jurisdiction of that court, and it is not the custom of sovereigns to suffer their names to be made use of in this manner. The answer is plain and easy. The government of each state ought to be subordinate to the government of the United States.
Okay, to be fair, I'm going to show you, because he follows it up with these parts of the Constitution to try to clarify that. To controversies between two states or more. In other words, the problem that they're talking about in jurisdiction, they basically talked about cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction. Next is to the controversies to which the United States shall be a party. And then they go into between two or more states, and then between a state and citizens of another state. So they're going through these different, very specific jurisdictions of the federal court. Keep in mind that there was pushback because most of the people did not like the fact that the federal government could inject itself in between a person of another state and a state sovereign, a state legislature. Ergo, it bothered these folks that the language of the Constitution granted them to inject themselves. That how long did it take for the 11th Amendment to come forth where those words were stricken from the Constitution? And so
right. If
you look at the 11th Amendment and you go, okay, so the 11th Amendment was basically proposed in 1794 and ratified in 1798. So in other words, the federal government put their nose into the state, in between states and citizens of other states and so forth, in these foreign states. And the state said, you know what, we're done with this. We're taking that jurisdiction away from you. Because we don't like the way you're getting your nose in and taking away our sovereignty. There you go. And so when you look at the jurisdiction that the federal government has, and the courts and so forth, and we actually held them to what was denned or what was contained in the Constitution, that only these things, they would not be, the federal courts wouldn't be as packed as they are, and the judges would probably be enjoying more vacations and traveling and so forth, because they just wouldn't be that busy. Because their jurisdiction only pertains to things arising under this Constitution. The federal government has assumed all sorts of things that aren't within the Constitution, and they make themselves busy hearing those cases and supporting them and validating them, when actually the fact that the courts have convened a case without the jurisdiction, that actually the court is in direct violation of the Constitution. In other words, the courts, the judges, those administrators of that court, they're all guilty of running an insurrection against the United States Constitution because they're assuming jurisdiction that is not granted. How is that not an insurrection?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is going through these things, I think, always helps, and it helps us place context to these things. Okay, so let's dive into the next one. What is the next one? Again, jurisdiction.
Yeah. between citizens of different states and between a state or to the citizens thereof and foreign states, citizens, or subjects, this part of the jurisdiction, I presume, will occasion more doubt than any other part, and at first view it may seem exposed to objections well-founded and of great weight. But I apprehend this can be the case only at first view. Permit me to observe here with regard to this power, or any other of the foregoing powers given to the federal court, that they are not exclusively given. In all instances, the parties may commence suits in the courts of the several states. Even the United States may submit to such decision if they think proper. Though the citizens of a state and the citizens or subjects of foreign states may sue in the federal court, it does not follow that they must sue. These are the instances in which the jurisdiction of the United States may be exercised. And we have all the reason in the world to believe that it will be exercised impartially, for it would be improper to infer that the judges would abandon their duty the rather for being independent. Such a sentiment is contrary to experience and ought not to be hazarded. If the people of the United States are fairly represented, the President and the Senate are wise enough to choose men of abilities and integrity for judges. There can be no apprehension because, as I mentioned before, the government can have no interest in injuring the citizens.
Okay, and he makes sense, but when you have judges that have aspirations, they want to do more, they want to, and when they actually reach out and they set precedents in doing something that's never been done before, boy, that just, it floats their ego. The point is that the states listened to this, they went ahead and ratified, and the bottom line is they weren't happy, and the 11th Amendment was driven by the states to actually take this jurisdiction away from them. Now, today, the federal government jumps in all of these cases. All of these cases, because they have no, there's nothing that keeps them from opening their doors because money is involved, and that's how they make money. So let's do the next jurisdiction. Go ahead. You know what? We have 30 seconds left. This would be a fatal exercise of futility because you'd start reading and then, oh, I got to cut you off. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
You're doing a great job, folks. If you tried to read these things out loud, you know, the language of hazard, I mean, who would use that word in that context? I mean, you're making sense of things, and it's difficult to actually think the way they spoke because they spoke different. Their speech was different. And my grammar and speech was pretty atrocious right there. Anyway, the point is that had you listened to me do this the first time, it would have been, you know, a travesty because, you know, I'm not really good at I'm good at comprehension, but just reading aloud for other people, I would have been tripping all over myself. But you're doing a great job, Tammy, and thank you. We'll have you back. Folks, we will be back, and we're going to dive more into the Pennsylvania debates. We're over halfway through, and we'll be back. I'm G.R. Mobley, Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.